It feels like a woman-shaped hole. Yeah, that's it. I need to be married. Because I'd look around, I'd see people really happy, and I got that, got that, got that, got that. Wife, don't have a wife. Need a wife. My first sponsor told me I would have married anybody I was dating at that point in my life. So I entered into this marriage, and we were married for about 4.5 years. Had a daughter who is, I could go on an hour about her. She is the light of my life. I never knew that I could love someone the way I love my daughter. I suspected in early sobriety that I had damaged myself to the point where I didn't have the capacity. And I love my daughter, and I know that I can love through her. And through the guys I sponsor, I love them, even the really sick ones. Anyway, I'm married 4.5 years, and there's some distance going on between me and my wife. But I am so involved in my business. I've got this opportunity to grow this business and to really, I mean, a once-in-a-lifetime financial opportunity. It was incredible. I'm also involved in a lot of committees in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sponsoring a lot of guys. My life is full. I mean, full. When your life is full, you don't notice things that there may be that are vacant. I didn't realize that. But my wife, the gal I was married with, is not involved in any of that. I am the center of her universe, and her life is desolate. And she's married to a guy who's so busy, he's really gone a lot. And we started having some problems, and she came to me. And part of my self-centeredness, it's an unconscious thing. I get so wrapped up in me that I don't pay attention. I'm not awake in my own life. Right, I'm asleep because I'm wrapped up in here. And I don't get it what goes on with people around me because I can't see past myself sometimes. And so that's happening. And my wife comes to me one day and she says, I want a divorce. Oh, there might be a problem here. Okay, I mean, you don't have to hit me with a too big of a 2x4. I get there's a problem here. So I said, my God, what's wrong? She says, I just don't feel good and I feel, you know, I'm alone all the time. And I... Well, let's try some different things. I'll cut back my hours. I'll change some things around. Well, let's go to counseling. We started going to marriage counseling. And went for several months to this marriage counseling. And through the whole thing, my sponsor has retired. He's on the road traveling around the country. And he's out of touch. So I have a guy, Craig, who's one of my favorite sponsees. And him and I become very close. And I'm using Craig to talk about the problems in my life. He's like my best friend. And we go to counseling for about three and a half months. And one day she comes to me. She says, I don't want to go to counseling anymore. I want out of the marriage. And I don't get it. I mean, like, God, we're doing everything here to try to save this. She said, I want out. And in Las Vegas, if you want a divorce, you can get a divorce quick. I mean, it's not like some states they make you wait. You can get within a week, you're done. You're out if you don't fight it. And we got a divorce on a Thursday. The next day, Friday, I discover that my wife and daughter move in with Craig, my best friend. And I discover that they had been sleeping together the whole last year of my marriage. And I find out it seemed like everybody in AA knows about it except me. Right? Now, I'm in my 11th year of sobriety. You guys have been telling me for 11 years there's no such thing as a justifiable resentment. Hey, I got one now, I'm telling you. And I can even find old-timers in the meetings. It'll agree how mistreated I've been. You know, you go up to them, and I'd start telling them my tale of woe, and they'd say to me, and didn't you just buy her a new car, Bob? And I'd say... Yes, as the nail holes in my hands would open up a little bigger, you know. And you know, if you've been there, there's an exquisiteness in the suffering, you know. For a little while, it kind of pumps the ego up, and you know you get a lot of attention. But then, if you're like me, you start to get really sick from this, you know, and it starts to eat your lunch, and I can't get out of it now. And I'm going to meetings trying to talk about it, trying to get free of it. And people in AA tell me crazy stuff. One guy says, well, just don't think about it. Right. How do you do that? How do you stop thinking about something you can't stop thinking about? It's like having a piece of flypaper on your hand. You can't get rid of it. One guy says to me, he says, well, if you believe in God, it shouldn't be a problem. Well, I believe in God, and it's a problem. It's a problem. And I don't know what to do. And I try to go through this part of the book, and I can't. I'm blocked. I'm too defended. I am not prepared as yet. It's too close yet to look at it from an entirely different angle. I know through being through this process intellectually that I will get free because I've had the experience. I've taken guys through it. I know the freedom is in the fourth step, is in the process of the resentment. But I can't do it. I'm not prepared. That's the truth. I know I should be, but I'm not. So God, in his graciousness, through hordes of newcomers and people sober a long time into my life to sponsor who are all going through relationship breakups. And I pile them in my car and we go to meetings. We're like the depressed section of the meeting, you know. You know, you can hear the chairman saying to the secretary saying to the chairman, don't call on those guys. But those guys saved my life. I'll tell you one incident. I was, you know, when it says in the sex inventory that we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. I was with my daughter one day, and she's only about 2 and a half, and I just adore her. She's just a sweetheart. And I took her to a friend of mine's ranch, and she could ride some ponies, and she loved that. And I went to get her a soda out of the machine next to the barn, and as I'm coming back, the girl that works there says, oh, here comes your daddy. And she looks at me, and she says, that's not my daddy. Craig's my daddy. And it felt like somebody took a knife and just put it right in here. And I didn't say anything, and I put the smile on my face. And I got her in the car, and I took her home that day. And I let her out, and I watched her run up the walk and jump into his arms. And I watched the three of them stand on the front porch and wave to me as I drove away alone. And I remember driving in the car, and I'm crying, and I'm telling God, I love my daughter, but I can't do this. This is too much for me. I'm not big enough to do this, God. I just can't. And I go to pick up a guy, and he gets in the car, and he starts crying because he'd been denied again by the courts to ever see his kids. And I went, okay, I can do this one more week. One more week. And I never did break that contact, and she has never not been a regular part of my life, which is so, I thank God for God's grace and the people in AA that encouraged me to do that. And then finally, after a while, I was able to do the step process. And I put both their names down, what they did, what was hurt, threatened, affected, or interfered with, everything, absolutely everything. And then the book says, are you prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle? And now I'm like the rat. I don't want any more cheese. I just want out of the trap. Right? Yeah, I'm ready. And it says we got to realize how the people that harmed us were perhaps like us, spiritually sick, even though we didn't like their symptoms, and the way they affected us, that they, like us, were sick too. So I had to do something. I had to other-center myself enough to look at the marriage and me from her eyes. And when I did that, I'll tell you, what I saw I didn't like. What I saw was a gal who wrapped her whole life around this marriage and was absolutely committed to it. And she was committed to a marriage to a guy who just all of it, after a while, wasn't there very much. And I started to experience and get her desolation and her loneliness and her fear. And after I really got it, I remember thinking to myself, my God, I would have done the same thing. I probably would have had an affair. I might have had an affair before she did, quicker than she did. She hung out a long time. And I started to have compassion for her desolation that she went through. And I was in sort of a little, I couldn't believe that I'd put up that facade of what a great husband I was because I never cheated on her and I always brought home as a good provider, brought home the money and all that other stuff. But where the rubber really meets the road in intimacy, the truth was, I was a terrible husband. The problem is that I don't know how to be intimate. At that time in my sobriety, I didn't have a clue. And so after about 6 months of a relationship, after the shine is worn off of me telling you all my favorite stories and everything, I run out of things to say and the emptiness is overwhelming. So I stay busy because I don't know what else to do. So I become a workaholic and an AA junkie and all that other stuff because it was convenient. Because then I could justify it all. Well, I have to build this business. It's a one-shot opportunity. And I have to do the AA, and it all had justification. But it was also very convenient because I didn't know how to be there with her. Once the small talk is over, I don't know how to just sit there and be with someone. And when I looked at it from her view, I started thinking, my God, I'm the guy who did this. My decisions based on self-centered fear set this whole thing up. And I started to realize if I would have gone to a leading university, a think tank, where there's experts on psychology, psychiatry, and sociology, and put a board of the leading experts in the world in those fields together in a room, when I first got married and said to them and gave them the task, I am marrying a woman who is loyal and monogamous and she's a good-hearted gal. Can you give me a game plan I could initiate over 3 years that would make a gal like this cheat on her husband? Can you come up with something that would work? I'm telling you, they wouldn't have come up with anything more effective than what I did. They couldn't have. And yet I did all of that and I don't even know I'm doing it. Made decisions based on self, which later placed me in that position to be hurt. You know, and these people that hurt me, I don't see why. I can't see the cause and effect because I can't see past my justifications and rationalizations. And I'm the guy. And I did the same thing with Craig. And Craig was easy. I'm a guy. I know how that is. When I know, I've learned to protect myself from certain situations because I know how guys are. We're dogs. It's awful. And you, the most morally standard guy in the world, if he get in the right set of circumstances and the doors open and he's been touched in certain ways, he'll be sitting there going, wait a minute, I had these principles a minute ago. Where'd they go? Because I know I have done things in my life that later I've been ashamed of, that later what I've done is I've acted like the guy I don't like. And so did Craig. And I understood that. He was easier than her, for some reason, to get that. And I sponsor him today. Matter of fact, when Ray came up to visit, Ray stayed with him. He's one of my top guys I sponsor. He's sober almost 20 years. And he's a great member of my home group. And he's a great, they got divorced. They got married and divorced. They couldn't stay together. And I'll tell you, this would only happen in AA. I spent 6 months trying to keep their marriage together. I'm not making that up. That's the truth. Really. And you know why I did it? Because once I got free, I realized that they were much better together than her and I ever were. And he was a tremendous stepfather for my daughter. Tremendous. I mean, if God, after I got free of the judgment and the resentment, if God would have came up to me and said, Bob, you need to pick, out of all the people on the planet, you got to pick a stepdad for your daughter, who would you pick? I'd pick him today. And how wrong I had been in all my judgments. The truth will set you free, but it'll screw your day up first. Let's break for lunch.
Howdy, and thanks for coming back. I'm Scott Lee. I'm alcoholic, and I've collected some quotations over the years that are just treasures to me. Here's one from Hank Williams Sr. He said, "A lot of good ideas in a pint, not so many in a quart." For me, that's always been one of the great truths, and I was reminded of an experience I had years ago. I had a traveling job, and I came home from about a 2-week trip. And my son was about a year and a half old at that point. And I can remember sitting on the couch watching him on the floor, crawling around in his diaper, and I'm loving him at a level he can't imagine. And everything that I have that's his, that would be good for him, he's welcome to, no charge. Just freely given. I want what's best for him. I know what it is, and he doesn't. And he is not even worried whether or not there's food in the refrigerator for lunch. It hasn't crossed his mind. He has every reason to expect all of his needs will be taken care of. And it doesn't matter how loudly he screams or how badly he wants them, I won't let him play with the razor blades. And that's me on the floor in the diaper, and that's God on the couch. I get a lot of my perspective of my relationship with God from my relationship with my children. And that was a great, great revelation for me. I have my own definition, by the way, for revelation. Revelation is when I figure out for myself something y'all been trying to tell me for 6 months or longer. That's revelation. Yeah. And I had another one. I had an experience quite a few years ago. I was about 2 years sober, and I was having a discussion. Now, not being as spiritually evolved as I am, you might have thought it was an argument, but I'm too spiritual for that, with another AA member before a meeting. And it was about something really, really important. I can't remember exactly what it was right now. And old Joe B. walked in, and Joe was very, very intelligent. He'd been sober since about 3 weeks before the earth began to cool. And with those two characteristics, is clearly going to be on my side of this burning issue, which I still can't remember what it was. And as he poured his coffee, I posed the question, waiting for him to back my play. And when he finished, he looked up and I said, "Joe, what do you think?" And Joe said, "I am not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Do not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorse nor oppose any causes. My primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety." And by the time he finished, my opponent and I were laughing. And a couple of weeks later, the light dawned. And I went to Joe and I said, "You meant that?" And he said, "Yeah." Joe B. was living the AA preamble. He was one of the most peaceful individuals I've ever known in my life. What I'd like to do now, on page 58 in the text, the most read, least understood, I think, maybe, certainly the least listened to portion of the work that we have. And if y'all would please play with me, I think you'll find this to be a lot of fun. I'm going to read this, and I'm going to ask a series of questions. I'm going to interrupt myself and ask questions. And the questions all have the same answer. All right? And I'm going to ask you to respond with the answer to try to make the point. Okay? And the answer, in all cases, is the 12 steps. Okay, are you ready? Let's try it once. The 12 steps. Very rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. What's our path?
The 12 steps.
Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. What's this simple program?
The 12 steps.
Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates, they are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They're naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. What is the manner of living demands rigorous honesty?
These 12 steps.
Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened. What happened?
These 12 steps.
And what we are like now. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. I wonder what steps they're talking about.
These 12 steps.
And some of these we balked. Some of what?
These 12 steps.
We thought we could find an easier, softer way. Easier and softer than what?
These 12 steps.
But we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Very start of what?
These 12 steps.
Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil. Till we let go, absolutely. Remember, we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. How are we going to get this help?
These 12 steps.
But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. What is the program of recovery?
These 12 steps.
Thank you. Kind of interesting how many references there really are there if you stop and look at them. I think that's kind of powerful. Talk a little bit about step four in general terms, and then I'm going to go back to some of the specifics. I was told that freedom is when I accept full responsibility for the results of all of my own actions. At that point, I'm free. Now, up until then, I may have been at large. But as some of us know, that can be temporary. Freedom is permanent as long as I'm willing to live with the results of my mistakes. They told me all my life we learn from our mistakes. They're wrong about that. I never did. Never did. I never learned from my mistakes. What I've learned from has been living with the results of my mistakes. I'm kind of like the dog that wets on the rug. What did he learn? Nothing. When did he start learning? When you rubbed his nose in it. And me and the dog have that in common. And I think we've got 5 steps that address that process. They're 4, 5, 8, 9, and 10 are about me literally embracing the results of my mistakes. And as I do that, that's where the learning process occurs for me. And the next time I'm in that situation, I don't stop and think, well, gee, that was a mistake last time. What I stop and think was, did you enjoy making amends for that? Yeah, that's the piece that slows me down. I sincerely believe the 4 steps are one of the easiest steps we've got. It's kind of long, but it's real easy. It's one of my mentors says that the alcoholic is kind of like an electromagnet that's been dragged through the junkyard of life. And all this rusty, jagged stuff has been collected all over us. And as we go through these steps, what we do is we slowly turn the current off. And that stuff drops away. And this beautiful person I always really was just kind of emerges. I like to say that, and it helped me a lot to be told that all that garbage in my past is not who I am. And it's not. That's who I'm not. Because if that's who I am, I'm still out there doing it. It doesn't make me sick in my stomach to think of some of it. That must be who I'm not. And what they've taught me here is how to stop doing who I'm not. How to make amends for doing who I'm not. How to receive the forgiveness for doing who I'm not. And who I really am kind of emerges from the ashes like the phoenix. If you haven't done step 4, I'll tell you something you haven't thought of. There aren't any surprises in it. I mean, you're the one that did all that, right? It's not like you don't already know. So you don't have to be afraid of that. There's no wispy what-ifs in step 4. You already know it. A friend of mine said, God forgives me for everything I ever did, and he loved me while I was doing it. My God got bigger that day. Got a lot bigger. And I believe from my own experience that I literally do not have the power to create a mistake so grievous that God can't turn it into something magnificent. Not just fix. The worst things I've done, I watch him regularly take and use as tools to help other people. Lack of power was my dilemma. I never had the power to do something that he couldn't turn into something magnificent. Page 124. I didn't know we were going to do this. This is one of the things they've recently added here to the book. I swear it is. A lot of it was here, but they've edited. And it says, this painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problem. Here's the part they just added. We think each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not. See, I always thought I owed this to the men that brought it to me, and I don't. It's been my experience when I've had the privilege of coaching someone through these steps and seeing the light come on in their eyes and knowing I was a tool in the master's hand. I've already been overpaid. They don't owe me a thing. And the men that carried this to me that got to see the lights come on in my eyes were overpaid, and I don't owe them a thing. I owe it to the next newcomer coming through the door. That's who I owe it to. Pretty clear. One of the things we do at my home group, many of us, is we've got a better plan than giving our phone numbers to newcomers because they're not going to call, right? Right? I mean, when I was sober 100 days, I bet I had 100 numbers. You know how many I'd called, right? Same number as you, right? Uh-huh, sure. What we do is we exchange phone numbers with them, guys with guys, girls with girls, and I task the men that I sponsor and myself, and when I exchange phone numbers with a new guy, I will call him twice in the next 3 days. It's nothing for me to pick up the phone and say, hey, I met you at the back room. I'm going to the fellowship meeting tonight at the church down on Nolensville Road, 8 o'clock. Maybe meet you there. We'll get a cup of coffee. I got a speaker tape you might enjoy. Or, hey, I talk to 5 or 6 guys every day that are in recovery. Talk to them on the phone. You're on today's list. How's it going? It's nothing for me to call him. He can't call me. We don't chase him. Just a couple of taps is all it takes. Just a couple. This thing says about the hand of AA always being there, and that for that I'm responsible. Wonder what would happen if we were able to stick the hand out just a little further. They're dying, you know. They're dying. I think it's so important that we do that. I think the two most important things we do here are make newcomers welcome and make those who are coming back welcome. If you are coming back, I'd like to say welcome. I'd like to tell you that I will do anything I can to make it easy for you to stay. And if anybody gives you any grief about having been back out, please give them my phone number. I'd like to talk to them. Like talk to them in the parking lot. I'll settle for on the phone. But I'm serious about that. Please, I'll make it as easy as I can for you to come back. Because if I go back out, please, God, make it easy for me to come back. I got nowhere else to go. This is all there is for me. I've got to do this thing. So let's make it easy. All right? Let's make it easy. Back to step four. I think one of the things that's really important is to make sure that this person's God is big enough. I need to see where he is, or we're still doing the act as if, as long as we're on a really good list on that. Let's make sure his God is not only big enough, but available, so he can hold the hand of this God as he goes into what looks to him like the dark cave of step four. It's not a dark cave. It's one of the easiest things he'll ever do, but he doesn't know that because he's been listening to the BS and the meetings of people who've done some of these guides and these pieces of trash that float around, written by, I'm sure, well-meaning people. I really mean that. I think there are two things in recovery that are the two single hardest things to do, two of them. One of them is thinking about doing a four-step. It's much more difficult than actually doing a four-step, right? And the other one is thinking about doing a nine-step. And since the book doesn't require me to think about doing either one of those anywhere, I'd like to recommend you don't do that. Lay that down. I think you'll be happy that you did. I read a book by a fellow who was an ordained minister in one of the fairly common Christian faiths. I don't remember. He was Methodist, Presbyterian, somewhere along in there. He was also a PhD, either psychologist or psychiatrist, and he was the chaplain of an insane asylum. And one day, this thought occurred to him, and he polled the patients in his insane asylum, and he asked them a single question. Would you rather be right or would you rather be free? And overwhelmingly, they said they would rather be right. Do you know, back when I was crazy, I would have rather been right too. And I have given up the need to be right. It's been my experience that I've never been angry when I wasn't also right. I've been right when I wasn't angry, but I've never been angry when I wasn't right. Play with that one a little bit. I think you'll like it. Page 66. I'm going to go back over some things that Bob very graciously left out because he knows I have a passion for these paragraphs, and that was very generous of him. Page 66. It is. So we're going to do some observations here. Actually, we're going to start at the bottom of 65. Said the first thing apparent was that this world and its people are often quite wrong. That's an observation. What I require from a man that I sponsor is a commitment to the following. Number one, that you want what the people who wrote this book had. And what they had was long-term, productive, happy sobriety. Is that what you want? Okay. Given that fact, as we come through this book, if they say they wrote something, you will stop and write it. If they say they prayed something, you will stop and pray it. If they say they did something, you'll stop and do it. If they say that they observed something, you'll stop and try to observe it. Seems like a fair request. And I ask for that. So they're observing here that the world and people are often quite wrong. I don't want to spend a lot of time on that one, because I think you already have spent a lot of time on that one. Right? Okay. Skip down to the next paragraph. It says, it is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. That's an observation. It's plain to them. Is it plain to you? Yeah. Have you ever seen anyone who had deep resentment that wasn't also futile and unhappy? Have you ever seen somebody that was happy, joyous, free, and deeply resentful? It's a good question. And then it says, to the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? Did you squander hours that might have been worthwhile? Yeah. Did you ever sit in class and hate them when you should have been listening? Yeah. Did you lay awake at night planning their demise? Could have been filing your nails. I mean, that could have been worthwhile. All right, squander means to throw away with no hope of recompense. So you threw it away, threw time away. All right. It says, both the alcoholic whose hope, you want to know what your hope is? Here it comes. The maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience. I couldn't hear that. Yeah, thank you very much. The 12 steps, yeah. Growth means what I've already got in enough. It means Scott Lee's 2004 program might not be good enough to keep him sober in 2005. Maintenance for me means two things. Maintenance means, number one, I can't afford to lose anything I've already got. But maintenance also means that I have to maintenance my spiritual experience in the same sense that I maintenance my vehicle. Change the oil, rotate the tires, keep the proper pressure in, wash it, those kinds of things. So I maintenance my spiritual experience by prayer, meditation, attending meetings, taking meetings into jails and treatment centers, reading spiritual literature, sponsoring some guys, having a sponsor. Got it? Saying please and thank you, letting people in traffic. So maintenance means to take care of, to maintain, in the sense of taking care of. It says, but with the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. Infinitely grave. Oh, my God. That sounds pretty serious. As a matter of fact, I think we just threatened your life. That's once. We found that it is fatal. That's twice. And I want to tell the story. A fellow's name. I've had several sponsors, by the way. For those of you who are new, I want to share something because it may not show up for me again. I was given a gift by my fourth sponsor, and that's how he told me how to drop my third sponsor. And what he said that you, and I dropped the most spiritual man I ever expect to know because he was unavailable. I called him on a Friday to tell him I'd ask someone else to sponsor me, left a message. It was the following Tuesday when he returned my call, and I was in the middle of a divorce. He's not a bad guy. His life was too full. I needed more than I could get. That's a good reason to move on. And I was told how to drop a sponsor, and what this man told me to do was thank him. And I said, thank you for all you've given me. Thank you for all the time. Thank you for all I've learned. It's only fair for me to tell you that I've asked someone else to sponsor me. And then I don't have to answer questions. Now, I would have if he'd asked any, but he didn't. He knew. If you ever have to do that and the person you're dropping becomes angry, the one thing you'll know for sure is you've done the right thing. Mm-hmm. Says, we found that it's fatal. I went to my second sponsor. I ran into him like 6 years later. And I said, do you remember Bill? And I'm not going to give his last name. And he said, sure. He said, if you ever sponsor anyone who commits suicide, you will always remember them. And I said, at 2 years sober, he and I had you, the same sponsor. We were plus or minus a couple of months on the same sobriety date. We had the same home group where I saw him 5 to 8 times a week. And at 2 years sober, he pulled into the garage after a meeting one night sober, dropped the door and left it running. He took his own life. And I sit here, sober 7 years, happy, joyous, and free, and scared. And I want to know what the difference was between me and Bill because I can't find it. And he said I could not get him to do a four-step. And resentment killed him. He died of it. And I thought about that. And I've talked to others who knew this man. And they all agree. Every time you saw Bill, he couldn't wait to run up to you and tell you what some SOB had just done to him. He was a victim all the time. And the victims don't get sober. Forgive me for being so direct. I haven't seen the victims get sober. And what we're approaching here is the forgiveness process that Bob talked about. Forgiveness process is in step 4. That's what we're talking about right here. So anyway, we found it's fatal. That's 2. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. Harboring is an interesting word. It doesn't say when having. Harbor to mean to give a safe place to nurture, to protect. I'm okay if I have a resentment if I'm not harboring it. And the directions for not harboring are coming. It says the insanity of alcohol returns. We drink again with us. To drink is to die. That's 3. It said if we were to live. Oh, this again. This only again for the ones that want to live. It's threatened my death, my life again. That's 4. We had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm are not for us. Kind of interesting thing. The word brainstorm really confuses a lot of us. It confused me. And I happened to hear a series of lectures one time by a guy who worked for Walt Disney. He actually ran Disney University. And he said in about the time this book was written, Walt Disney came up with this idea for how to write a Mickey Mouse cartoon. And people would sit around and spit out ideas about that. And they called it brainstorming. But if you look up brainstorm in a 1930s dictionary, which I did, it says transient, violent, mental outburst. That means rage. Okay? This brainstorm we have down here has nothing to do with brainstorming. I'm told I'm made in God's image. There's one thing I'll tell you for sure about God. He's creative. It's okay to be creative. All right? That's not what they're talking about. That's rage. Brainstorm, as is written in here, is synonymous with rage. So there are 2 kinds of anger, the grouch or the slow burn, and the detonation, rage. Change the meaning. And then here, you talk about something thin. Listen to this. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men. Boy, that's thin. But for alcoholics, these things are poison. Threatens your life a fifth time. We turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. The key to the future, does that mean if I don't get this right, I don't have a future? Six. We're prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. Different from what? Well, the last time we looked at the list was actually that first sentence I read here. It began at the bottom of 65. The first thing apparent was that the world and its people are often quite wrong. It's the last time we've looked at the list. Now, once again, this is a place where I have some fun with the guys I sponsor. It says we were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. It doesn't say how they prepared. So I don't care how you prepare, but you will. You stand up, shake out your writer's cramp, go wash your face, walk around your chair four or five times, announce out loud you're preparing, and you're now prepared. And I'll expect to know tomorrow how you prepared. And I'm that serious about it. And I don't care what they do, as long as they do something to announce that they're now prepared. And then it says, we began to see that the world as people really dominate us. Let's go back to your list and go through them one at a time. Let's see how this dominated you. Did it dominate you because your father beat you down so far that you couldn't tell anybody no and you're still scared of authority figures? Did it dominate you because you hated this guy so bad that you planned your life so you'd never be around him so he couldn't get you again? Or did it affect you that you hated him so bad you were around him as much as you could so if he ever made a mistake you could point at it and make sure everybody knew? Did it dominate you because it cost you sleep, cost you time and clay? How did these things dominate you? Let's spend some time and have a look at that. And then it says, in that state, that's the state of being dominated by these resentments, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, Bob covered that beautifully, had the power to actually kill. Oh, here we are again. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered. Time out. Do you see that? They saw it. This is again red flag analysis by me. I'm a salesman by trade. I understand that's what Bill was. And I think what you've just seen here is a fabulous sales presentation. A good salesman will never, ever mention price until he's already established value. We've threatened your life seven times. Because we know you have a little learning disability. You'd have been here before you started shaving. All right, so have we made our sale? I think that's the question here. Are you willing to let them go at absolutely any price? That's the question. Because I can't wish them away. I used to say, yeah, I forgive you. But you'd be real smart not to ever turn your back on me. Yeah, that's not forgive. This was our course. We realized, our friend Don from Louisville, Kentucky, does it this way. Look at me. He says, I realized. I can know something up here, but when I realize it, it becomes real for me. It's what my wife calls heart knowledge. Let me get it down here. People were perhaps spiritually sick, and another one of my mentors defined spiritually sick as cut off from God. I have something the angels don't have. I have the ability to turn my back on God and go right back to doing it my way. And that's what I was doing when I did those things. I'm not going to call on anybody, all right? I want you to bring into your mind now the one or two worst things you ever did. Got them? Weren't you cut off from God when you did that?
Yes. Hmm?
Had you been walking in the sunlight of the Spirit in conscious contact with this glorious, generous, loving God who created all this stuff and who loves you beyond your capacity to receive, had you been walking in contact with Him, could you have done that? No. Would you have thought of doing it? Probably not. No. You were spiritually sick. And these people who wronged you were spiritually sick too. Because spiritually healthy people in contact with the great reality don't do those kinds of things to God's kids. And what I require the men that I sponsor to do is to go through that list one at a time. We're still doing 30-minute sessions. We haven't written anything for a while. We're working hard on step four. We're digging hands full of poison out of your soul here. That's what this whole thing is about right here. And I require them to go through that list one at a time. And in the 5 minutes before that session, you're going to ask for courage and clarity, and you're going to talk to God about those two or three worst things you ever did and how sad you are that you did them and how if you'd been connected to Him, you would not have done them. And that will put you in a really good position then to go down the list one at a time. First name on the list, Fred. God, please help me grant Fred spiritual sickness rather than SOBism. Second name on the list, Martha. Father, please help me grant Martha spiritual sickness rather than SOBism. I want you to do the whole list once. Let's ask God for that. I had an amazing experience a number of years ago. I explained that this spiritually sick thing to a guy. We were sitting in a restaurant. This guy I sponsored. And I saw him physically change. And the forgiveness process was over for him. He had it. I've only seen it once. It was an astonishing thing. And then top of the next, and I stopped there. Because that's going to take him a couple of days. He's probably got 160 resentments. Right? He told me he only had 4 or 5, but I said, go ahead and sit down and do some writing anyway. He got about 160. And so it's going to take a couple of sessions to get through that. And then at the top of the next page, we didn't like their symptoms the way these disturbed us. They, like ourselves, are sick too. Let's take that apart. We didn't like their symptom. The symptom of their spiritual sickness is whatever they did to me that left me with a resentment. The way they disturbed me is my resentment. And then the great truth, again, here, two sentences in a row, they, like ourselves, were sick too. That must be awfully important. They've just told me twice. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. I would observe on that I'm praying for myself. And some of my mentors who got sober on the second edition don't do what I'm about to do. I think one of the most popular misquotes in our fellowship is, more will be revealed. Shout out the page number, I dare you. Page 164 says, God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. And I refer to the story section, to the more will be disclosed section. Page 551 in the story of Freedom from Bondage. If you haven't read the stories, do yourself a favor. This lady is talking about a resentment against her mother. Now, she's gotten rid of the rest of them. She's down to one. Bottom of page 551, fourth edition. One morning, however, I realized I had to get rid of it. That's the resentment against her mother. For my reprieve, look up reprieve in your dictionary. It's a stay of execution. We're under death sentence here. Reprieve was running out, and if I didn't get rid of it, I was going to get drunk, and I didn't want to get drunk anymore. Now, look at the chain of events. In my prayers that morning, I asked God to point out to me some way to be free of this resentment. During the day, a friend of mine brought me some magazines to take to a hospital group I was interested in. I looked through them, and a banner across one featured an article by a prominent clergyman in which I caught the word resentment. Look at the chain of events. She sees something about herself that needs to be changed. And notice I didn't say something wrong with her. We're children of God. There's nothing wrong with us. There's some things about us could stand to be changed and worked on and grown from, but I don't think there's anything wrong. She saw something, she prayed about it, and then what'd she do? She got focused on helping somebody else. And her answer fell out of the sky on her. And I've seen it over and over, and that is a predictable chain of events. So I don't solve my problems. What I do is talk to God about them, I talk to my sponsor, other spiritual people that I know about them, and I get focused on helping somebody else, and my answer falls out of the sky on me, or the problem evaporates. I cannot explain that. I can report it. It's very consistent. Back to 552. He said, in effect, if you have a resentment you want to be free of, there's a good question. Do you want to be free of it? Do we make our sale? Was 7 death threats on one page enough for you? If you will pray for the person or the thing you resent, you'll be free. If you will ask in prayer for everything you want for yourself to be given to them, you will be free. As for their health, their prosperity, their happiness, and you will be free. Even when you don't really want it for them, and your prayers are only words, and you don't mean it, go ahead and do it anyway. And it says do it for 2 weeks and it'll be gone. That has not been my experience. Although I'll admit this is a pretty highly spiritually evolved lady who's down to one. So, I don't know. But I know this, that adding that prayer to this one here is what I was shown to do, and I sure have seen it work. And so, we're going to still be doing these 30-minute sessions, and I want you praying in the shower when you're driving your car, anytime you think of one of these people. First name on the list, Fred. God, please help me grant Fred spiritual sickness rather than SOBism. Please grant me the ability to show him the same tolerance, pity, and patience I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. And then I ask that you would, for Fred, that his children go to school on scholarship and never give him any trouble, that he gets promoted at work, that he wins the Kentucky lottery, that his wife is fabulous in bed, that, why not? That his lawn grows lush and green, but it grows so slow he only has to mow it once a year. Right? That he has a magnificent spiritual experience and walks in the sunlight of the Spirit for the rest of his days. I didn't ask you to mean it. And I tell the guys I sponsor, if you need to preface your prayers by saying, look, God, this fool you've got sponsoring me has told me to do this, and I'm only doing it to show him it won't work. If you need to start there, I'm good with it. We're not asking you to lie to God. That's not what's going on here. If you need to start there, I'm good with it. And when you get through with that prayer for that one individual, you ask yourself a simple question, do I mean it? That's a yes or no, but that's not an essay question. That's a yes or no. And if the answer is no, you move on to the next name. If the answer is yes, put a check mark by it and move on to the next name. When we get to the end, we're going to start over again with just the ones that aren't checked. The English language, in my experience, has it wrong. Forgive isn't something I do, it's something I receive. I got here locked up like this, and what you've taught me is to open to receive the gifts that have always been here. I don't think it's ever been God's unwillingness to give. It's been my inability to receive. When I get to the point where I don't hate somebody anymore, where that stuff is gone for me, I haven't given them something. I have received something. And this is a process, and I'm not saying there aren't others, that opened my soul up to receive the gift of forgiveness. I think of resentment kind of like ice around my heart. And what we do here with these prayers is hold the icy heart up to the sunlight of the Spirit. And the thickness of the ice is maybe based on how long I've had this resentment, how much I've nurtured it. And maybe the time frame has to do with how close I can hold it to the sunlight. Eventually, the sunlight will melt the ice. And the day will come where I really do hope that he has a fabulous life. And that's gone for me. And I am at that point free. And I will have received forgiveness. We pray an interesting prayer at the end of a lot of the meetings. And one of the phrases in there says, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. I think that says, God, if I don't forgive them, don't you forgive me? I think that's what that says. My sponsor explained it to me this way. He said, you got here wanting mercy for you and justice for everybody else. That one hit pretty hard, didn't it? And the package is justice for everybody or mercy for everybody, and you are part of everybody, and you get to choose. And I am not in a position to face justice, nor will I ever be. And I have therefore chosen mercy for everyone. And I've gotten free. And I wouldn't take anything for it. I'm lighter. I feel differently. It's a fabulous process. Fabulous process. I loved what... Here coming after that. And that sometimes takes months. Sometimes that takes months and months. I really don't care how long it takes. It's only going to kill you. You plan to live to be 127 anyway, don't you? I mean, we got plenty of time. And then it looks to me like the marching orders for from here on, what am I supposed to do? When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. Here's another prayer. This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry. Thy will be done. That's what I'm supposed to do when you cut me off in traffic. That's what I'm supposed to do when you make me mad now. It says we avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. That's interesting. Page 77. What are we really trying to do here? Third line, page 77. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. Well, it's hard to do when you're mad at him, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And here's a promise. We cannot be helpful, back on 67, cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. What a promise. That's been my experience. And it says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done. Boy, that's hard to do if you still hate them now, isn't it? Maybe we ought to do the prayers first. Maybe we ought to get the poison dug out of our soul first before we try this. We look for our own mistakes, and Bob covered that beautifully. Nowhere does it tell me to look for my part. And I'm not going to redo that. I thought that was great. And then further down, I think there are a lot of really good ways to follow what's on this paragraph. And I'm not near as hung up on format as I appear to be. I think the new people need to think I am. I think it's real important to them. But the truth is, I think there's an awful lot of right ways to do this under the care of a sponsor. One of my mentors does this paragraph in sentence form. Another one does lists. I think there are a lot of right ways to do it. I'm a fourth column fan because I think it makes step 8 really easy. And so that's how I tell them what we're going to do is a fourth column. And you're going to write down what you did wrong. And you don't have much room. So let's don't be bashing ourselves, because the reason we're doing that is down here at the bottom. It says we admitted our wrongs honestly and we're willing to set these matters straight. Gee, that sounds like step 8, doesn't it? There's another reference later on in step 4 that sounds a lot like 8. This thing we do is really fluid. I want to cover up something else. I got started and I get so excited up here. Back on page 65, We counted the words under the cause there for Mr. Brown. It came to 19. And I limit the guys I sponsor to 19, but I tell them I'm flexible. And if you think you've got somebody who's done more than that to you, you want to write the 20th word, call me. We'll talk about it. I'll be glad to negotiate that. I'll tell you I've never given it up, but I'll be willing to talk about it. Truth is, I've never been called. You wouldn't call me, would you? They wouldn't either. Okay, bottom of 67. I'm not going to read this paragraph, but it says basically fear is not real good stuff, and we got to get rid of it too. Turning the page tells us how to go about that. It says we reviewed our fears thoroughly. That's a general description. They're going to tell me exactly how to do that. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. So I got two kinds of fears, those that have a resentment connected and those that don't. Typically, although not always, the fear list is a bit shorter than the resentment inventory. So if you had 200 resentments and you only come up with 42 fears, you're probably all right. Don't worry about it. We're not grading you on how many. Besides that, you already got your grade on this thing. If I spawn, you got your F minus, you're not getting the trophy. We're going to be doing this again anyway. And so it says we asked ourselves why we had them. I will be forever grateful that they tell me why, because I didn't have a clue. Why did I have fears? And the answer is, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? And I think the question that brings to my mind is, go down your fear list and ask yourself this question. If you were totally God-reliant, 100%, would you have that fear? Would you? One at a time, ask yourself that question. Pretty good question. Next paragraph. Perhaps there's a better way, we think so, for we're now on a different basis. The basis of trusting and relying upon God. Let's take a look at Roman numeral 16. Forward to the second edition. Bill Wilson is about to leave the Oxford groups. He loves a lot of what they're doing and is going to carry it with him, but he can't take it all. About 8 lines from the top, XVI in the forward to the second edition. Though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford groups, he was convinced of the need for moral inventory, confession of personality defects, restitution, that'd be different from apology, restitution to those harmed, helpfulness to others. Listen to this one. And the necessity, wonder how important that is, the necessity of belief in and dependence upon God. That really struck me, that belief in God and dependence on God are separate concepts. I got here pretty much believing there was a God and not having a higher power. And I don't think that's real uncommon. Belief in and dependence, that's what we're talking about here. Back on 68. Different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns. Step 1, section B. He assigns the role. I love this little story that God invented this particular kind of animal, and He gave this animal a taste and a hunger only for the leaves that grow at the top of a particular kind of tree. And He also gave the giraffe a long neck so He could get to him. I have a long neck for God's will for me. I quote my wife who says, God's will is a good deal. Boy, that helped. Because I've been afraid of it for a long time. I was just wrong about that. And then it says, just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity? That looks to me like permission to make a mistake. Just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us. I don't always know. Do you? Don't always know. And I think it's okay when I make mistakes. If I'm trying to do what I think God wants me to do and I make a mistake, well, I'll tell you this, I'm still making mistakes. But I make a much finer quality mistake today than I ever made before. We have a name for that. Call it progress. Think about it. Progress is a better quality of mistake. It's exactly what it is. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. That's another one of those twice in the same paragraph deals. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it's the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. Boy, we're back to that. That must be important. It just keeps coming. We never apologize for God. There it is again. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear. I would say that was a prayer. I claim it's a series of lists, observations, and prayers. On this one, we've listed our fears. We've observed that we have them because self-reliance failed us. If we were God-reliant, we wouldn't have them. We've observed that it's not only believing in God, but trusting Him. We've found permission to make a mistake. We've been told twice not to apologize. A lot of observations on this one. And here's the prayer. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us do. And that is not what it says. Direct our attention to what He would have us be. Have us be. That one troubled me for a long time. And I don't claim this is a whole thing, but I did find something fairly interesting under the "What would God have me be" category on page 133. Second line. We are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. And I think anything I can add to that list that fits is within the Master's will for me. Anything I add to that list that doesn't fit, isn't. I'll give you a couple examples. Happy, joyous, free, and trying to be a good dad. Yeah. Happy, joyous, free, and trying to be a good employee. Yeah. Happy, joyous, free, and cheating on my taxes. Sorry. Okay, back to about page 68. What a promise at the last sentence. At once we commence to outgrow fear. What a promise. Outgrow fear? If I can outgrow fear, does it seem like fear must be a lack of growth? Spiritual growth is my guess. And that's the end of the middle third. Now about sex. Many of us, how do you love that? Many of us need an overhauling here. Above all, we try to be sensible on this question. It's easy to get way off track. We find human opinions running to extremes. Absurd extremes, perhaps. I'm going to skip some of that stuff. Five, six lines down on page 69. One school would allow a man no flavor for his fare. For those of you who are younger than I am, which covers the vast majority, the word fare isn't like bus fare. It means food. Someone who is faring well is eating well, high off the hog. That's where that comes from. And so this is his metaphor here, is about how well you're eating. A menu was at one time called a bill of fare. That's what the word means there. And the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. Oh, okay, Bill. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. Boy, if it's good enough for him, it's good enough for me. I do not want to be. However, I got this from one of my mentors, and it's helped me so much. He said when he gets a new fellow to sponsor, if the guy is single, what he says to him is, I'm going to recommend that you leave the ladies completely alone. Right now, you're a very, very sick fellow, and your chances of attracting a healthy female are not good. Most healthy females run screaming from guys like you. Now, I'm going to ask you to do that for two reasons. One is I want your time and energy on this step work so we can get you healthy. One of the side effects is you'll have a chance to attract a healthy female. The other reason is that, I guess I gave two, didn't I? I hope I did. Yeah, maybe find a healthy female and I need your time and energy for this work. Now, you may choose to ignore my suggestion. That'll be your choice. However, don't bring me the problems you create for yourself in this category by breaking that. I've already told you what I think you need to do. So that solves my problem, because I don't have to deal with it. At my home group, they say two ding-a-lings don't make a bell. They also say the rocks in his head were a perfect match for the holes in hers. And I heard this the other day and loved it. The AA program cannot be sexually transmitted. I think that one ought to be on the wall, don't you? Okay, back to the text. Excuse me. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. Here's the question. What can we do about them? We reviewed our own conduct over the years past. All right, that's a general description. Here's what we're going to review. Where had we been? Selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? And then it says we got all this down on paper and looked at it. It doesn't tell us exactly how to put it down on paper. And again, one of my mentors does this in sentence form. And I think there are a lot of right ways. I've gotten used to column inventory, so that's what I like to do. And I like to start with whom had we heard. That's a pretty good place to start. And then you can use these other sentences as columns, with the last one being, where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? Mine are pretty simple here, and I hope I don't offend anyone here, but I think it's going to be really important. One of the things that keeps the trash in my past clean is that I'm willing for God to use it. My last column on this one says either I should have told her the truth, or it says I should have told her, I should have left her alone, or it says I should have told him no. I've got a good friend who's a very skilled therapist who says about 70% of adult males have had a homosexual experience of some kind. I've heard over 100 fifth steps, and I'm going to guess 98 is a better number. So you new guys, if that's the one you're hiding, we already know it. All right? And I got free of that. Nothing happens in here when I talk about it anymore. Okay? That's what this is about, freedom. This is about digging this poison out of my soul. Whatever it is you got, Bob was right. We've heard it. We've heard it. So let's get it down on paper and look at it. And why are we doing that? Here's what it says. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. So we're not here to bash you for what you did in the past. We're trying to figure out what your ideal is for the future. Now, gentlemen, the ideal isn't like, you know, 5'5 and a size 7. No. The ideal has to do with your own conduct. And I think it'll help you a lot to put the word today in. Then it says, we subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? Here's the first of several prayers in this portion. It's okay to pray about sex. My sponsor says he has it on good authority that God actually invented sex. Okay? We ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. Remember it always, our sex powers are God-given and therefore good, neither be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised or loathed. And I think it's really helpful after that to sit down and write your ideals. How are you going to live up to it if you don't know what it is? And I ask him to know no more than about this on a piece of paper, your ideal. And you want to use the word today in that because it could change. Now, mine's fairly simple right now. Miss Linda's supposed to get all of my sexual energy. Mine's pretty simple. I'm married to a fabulous woman. That's the way it's supposed to be for me. But I remind the guy that we're not trying to fix the rest of your life. We don't need to know, like, what it would be if you were married but you're single but you thought she had a boyfriend but you weren't sure but you were legally separated. We don't need that. We need to know, what do you think God wants you to do in this category today? The today word's really magic on there. And then it says, whatever ideal turns out to be, you must be willing to grow toward it, willing to make amends where we've done harm. Gee, that sounds like step 8 again, doesn't it? Provided we don't do more harm. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem, which is to say we inventory it, we pray about it, we try to figure out what God wants to do about it, and then move in that direction. Here we go again. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter, and the promise, the right answer will come if we want it. I'm going to skip a paragraph, and I'm going to summarize the next one, which says, if you're continuing to do things that are hurting other people, you're going to drink, and that's not if, that's when. That's a guarantee. And then it says, to sum up about sex, we earnestly pray. Here we are praying one more time. Earnestly pray for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. That is a concept that is all over this book. The word altruistic appears twice before page 1. This is always about helping somebody else. It gets me out of me. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. What we have following this is a checklist. If we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we've written down a lot. If you've written down all the things Bob and I found in here that call for writing, you'll have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We covered that, didn't we? We've begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. Did we cover that? Yeah. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. See that? We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. Did we cover that? Sure. We have listed the people we hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. That was in the resentment inventory and the sexual misconduct inventory. We did that, right? If you've done a four-step some other way and you can't say yes to all of those things, please try this. That's the checklist. Have you done these things? And then here it says in this book you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you're convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you've already made a decision, that would be the third step, decision, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, we just covered that, you've made a good beginning. This being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Step four is one of the easiest things you'll ever do. It's a little bit long. It's real easy. We'll start again at 2:30. I just love that part.
My name is Bob Darrell. I'm an alcoholic. It's a long day. Are you having fun? Oh, good. I'm glad I'm not the only one. Couple things. I don't know what it's my lot in life, but I end up with having a lot of guys that I end up sponsoring that are sober a long time, that are 20 years plus sober, and they're dying. And some of them are almost suicidal or getting ready to drink, and they're very lonely and depressed, and they're on the verge of getting on meds or doing something, and they're desperate. And they come to me, and they've done everything in Alcoholics Anonymous there is to do except to really do this. Which is like they haven't done anything, really, but being kind. They were on a lot of committees, and they went to a lot of meetings, and they didn't drink. Oh, boy, didn't they drink. And I had this guy a couple years ago. He's actually sober longer, a little bit longer than I was. And he came to me and asked me to sponsor him. And his name was Jerry. And Jerry's a great guy. Now, Jerry was sober 23 years with the benefit of step none. To say he was a little brisk would be an understatement. I mean, he was a little bit wound up, a little bit tight, and a lonely guy. An angry, lonely guy. And so I got Jerry going through the steps, and we get to step four, and I told him, I said, I want you to make a list of your resentments. And he's an old ex-Navy chief, tough guy, deep, gravelly voice. I don't have any resentments. Nobody gets to me. I said, Jerry, I know you have resentments. No, I don't know. I let go of it. They don't get to me. Well, he's the most resentful guy I know, right? So I said, okay, Jerry, in your case, we're going to do something different. I don't want you to make a list of resentments. I want you to make a list of people you feel smugly superior to. And he gets this look on his face like, oh, this is going to be a long list. And then about a week later, I'm at the step study meeting after the meeting, and he's got me cornered in the parking lot. And he's going on and on about all these people and his family and people in AA. And he just knows what's wrong with everything. He's just this and that, this and this person, this and that. He's going on and on. And it's just wearing me out. And when he's finally done, I said, look, Jerry, I got enough. I'm going home. But I want you, will you do something tonight? Would you say a prayer? And he said, yeah, I'll say a prayer. What prayer do you want me to say? I said, just, Jerry, go home, get down on your knees and say, God, please, tomorrow, would you judge me and treat me the way I've been judging and treating people today? And I walked away from him, and I get halfway to my car, and I'm not going to tell you what he said, but I heard this, yo, across the parking lot. Right. As it sunk in what that prayer would have meant. Right. So. Yeah, you know, I really enjoyed the things that Scott covered in the fear section. And just briefly, it uses the word one at the very beginning of the fear section. It says something that I want to talk about for a minute because it seems to be one of the reasons I can't manage my own life. It's one of the reasons I'm here. It's one of the reasons I can't trust my own judgments about my life and my own defensiveness. Talking about fear, third line up from the bottom of 67, it said this fear, it says they set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve, but did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? What's that mean? Well, I'll tell you, what it means to me is that I have, all my life I've had these fears, and then I have these reactions to those fears that are my defense mechanisms, the way that I defend myself against my fears or try to protect myself from the thing I'm afraid is going to happen. And what eventually happens is I make the fear come true. Psychiatrists call it self-fulfilling prophecies. And I'll give you a couple quick examples. Early sobriety, my first relationship in sobriety, I was a little over a year sober. I didn't know it, but I really didn't have much self-esteem. I believed my judgments of myself more than I believed anything you would say to me or that God would love me or anything else, really. And because I didn't have much self-esteem, I enter into this relationship coming from behind with a sense that I'm not really up to this. Like in a fear, here's my primary fear, is that she's going to dump me for somebody who has more going on for him than me, right? That's my basic fear. But how I try to protect myself from that fear is the fear drives me to be the guy who's possessive, to be the guy who's smothering, the guy that's always watching her. If she's hugging a guy in the meeting, I'm going, what about wife? Hey, what are you doing there? You know, I'm that guy. I'm that crazy guy, right? I'm the guy who's driving by her apartment in the middle of the night to make sure no guy's cars are there. I'm the guy that's, when she leaves the room, I look through her purse, make sure no guy's phone numbers are in there. You know, I'm that guy. She said to me one time, she said, every time I look up at a meeting, you're looking at me. I don't know what you're talking about. She said, you're smothering me. I don't know what you're talking about. And I was doing all of that. But I couldn't see it because I'm driven by fear, right? I'm driven by fear. And what happened is that I literally drove her out of my life. And as she's leaving, a little voice in the back of my head said, see, you were right. I like being right. Even if I'm broken and alone and feel like killing myself, at least I was right. And I think somehow that's that kind of obsessive energy that I pour into it is like a type of prayer, and I make it come true. I had a job one time. The last time my parents ever really went to bat for me, I was kind of destitute, and I was in a lot of trouble, lost another job. And my father last time he went to bat, he had this friend who had started an environmental engineering outfit. And this is back in the 70s when environmental air pollution, water pollution was cutting edge stuff. This guy was on the ground floor of an industry that was about to explode. And he was doing testing for air pollution and industry and water pollution and designing scrubbers and doing all that stuff. And he gave me a job and an opportunity to pay for my education and so I could become an environmental engineer, which for a guy who had nothing going for him, this was a tremendous opportunity. But I went to work and I was afraid. And my fear, my primary fear is I'm afraid I'm going to be rejected by the guys that work there. I'm afraid that their conversations out of earshot from me are something along the lines of, you see that Bob? You know, the only